Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Purva Gupta. Purva is the founder of Lily, which is an app that helps women discover and buy clothes according to their own perceptions of their body. Purva is one of the most passionate individuals I ever came across. She's very passionate about startups in general and also her product. She's extremely hardworking and she really surpassed many obstacles like visa challenges, cultural differences, and many more. In today's episode, she goes through a lot of her struggles and how she overcame them. Without further ado, here is my conversation and interview with Purva. Purva, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Hey, Rohit, thank you so much. It is absolutely my pleasure.
So I will get to the story behind how you built your company. But before I do that, I want to start with one specific incident. What happened on February 10th of 2015 when you're trying to get funding for your company?
So on that specific day, I met the founding partner of Unshackled, Nitin Pachisia. I was a part of this incubator called Founder Institute. And during that process at the incubator, I was trying to do customer development for my product, trying to understand women's shopping behavior more. While I was going through that process and trying to crack that code of what is the key problem that I'm going to solve. But at the same time, as an immigrant, I was also trying to understand the whole company building process and trying to understand how can I solve my visa problem so that I can get into a situation of creating an awesome company and adding value to the American ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And so I met Nitin, and what I understood in that process is that he has started an absolutely fantastic initiative at that time called Unshackled, which is a fund which backs immigrant entrepreneurs like myself. It's a venture capital fund and backs immigrant entrepreneurs in their entrepreneurial journey. And of course, helps them in with their immigration challenges. And so I met him, and in my journey, what I understood is that Unshackled was very excited to back me as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. and help me in my journey, and
they were basically willing to fund you and sponsor your visa at that time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And when did you know that this was going to happen?
So they weren't ready. There was an indication from them, which was the biggest thing for me at that point in time, because I knew that there is an opportunity for me to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Because before that time, I didn't even know how do I make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned when we were talking earlier that on February 20th, you got a call back from Unshackled that
yes.
they are ready to sponsor you and fund you. And you had to get everything ready by April, which is like 1 month. And what you were previously planning to do in a couple of months. Is that right?
Absolutely. And so typically H-1B visas are filed on 1st of April. And from 20th February, I had only around 40 days to kind of make that happen. And so I had to go through a series of challenges with regards to the funding required. Because it was such a short span of time, because of the deadline imposed by the situation of 1st April, because there was just such a short span of time to get all the documentation ready, my visa application ready.
I see.
I had to expedite the progress that I had to show to an investor to be able for them to take a bet on me and to back me and to take that decision. Otherwise, typically it takes at least 3 to 4 months of a process that an investor goes through with a particular entrepreneur or a company that they want to fund. Mm-hmm. But just because of how that deadline, and also for them to see the opportunity in what I was trying to do, I think it was a very interesting problem for me to solve. Also from the perspective that, like I mentioned to you before, I came to Silicon Valley with almost zero connections. Mm-hmm. The only person that I knew when I landed here was the guy who had approved my Founder Institute application, Mark. Uh-huh. And so I mean.
So to be able to connect with new people and
absolutely and raise
building
money,
trust,
I mean,
and raise money and building
and not so I mean to not have a school network support you so much here. I don't have U.S. education, and so not have a lot of work experience in the U.S. and not have that kind of a connection here.
Yeah,
not have that kind of a network here was a difficult start for me. Mm-hmm. That's how maybe the story becomes a little bit more interesting.
Yeah. So what I love about that is that you squeezed a 3-month project into a 1-month project, which is very typical in the startup world, right? You are on a tight deadline and you figure out
Absolutely.
A way to make it happen, and you did it in this case. So I want to go back, step back a little bit, mm-hmm. and ask you about how you ended up in the U.S.
So I basically moved to the U.S. as an immigrant. And my key reason of moving here was my job at UNICEF that I secured after my MBA, and my husband started his MBA at Yale in New Haven. And so those were the two key reasons that made my transition here to the U.S.
Were you an H4 when you moved to the U.S.?
So no, because I also had my job here. Uh-huh. So but at the same time, I was an immigrant, and so when I started working with UNICEF, I started on a G4 visa.
Mm-hmm. What's a G4 visa?
So it's a diplomat visa, which is issued for immigrants. And so which is issued for immigrants working with the United Nations, uh-huh. and other agencies. And so
other international agencies.
Yes.
I see. You are the first one here on Breaking the Borders podcast who has been on a G4 visa, I must say.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we even had a lawyer come mm-hmm. here, and even she didn't talk about the G4 visa, so it's very new.
Sure.
Yeah, so how did you convince them to sponsor a G4 visa for you? Is it common for them to do it, or was it a special case?
So I had to absolutely work for a few months without pay to prove my case, to be absolutely important to the team, and for them to take that step and go and file my G4 visa. But in terms of as all these international development agencies work, you know, it is not new for them to be able to offer G4 visas for their employees that they are trying to hire who are you know, from different countries. So yeah.
So what were you doing at UNICEF?
So I was hired at UNICEF to start this experiment, which was UNICEF was trying to set up a venture capital fund like vehicle where they would invest in their own innovation projects and see if they grow faster, like when VCs invest in startups. And so it was an experiment. We raised about $4.5 million. Now, of course, the fund has raised more money. And we were trying to invest in UNICEF projects across the globe, and really recognizing some really good innovative disruptive technologies that that we in house had you know, created, and we were trying to get mentoring from the VC world for all those projects to see if they can grow faster with the help from the private sector.
What is impact investing as such? How is it like different from traditional investing, let's say?
So so the key difference between them is really the type of product that they fund, I think. Mm-hmm. So which is and the type of impact that the product has, for example. I mean, both are trying to work towards a goal of creating both social and economic value. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the type of product which is able to do that is, I think, different in either of the cases. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of does. So basically, you're trying to... The goal is different.
So the goal is the same, actually, to have an economic and a social impact for any company that... so let's say if it's a Coca-Cola or if it's a new startup, and any company is trying to create both social and economic value. I mean, in terms of social value, in terms of, you know, all the employees who, you know, who get paid and all the households that that run because of that company, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think it's about the product. So let's say a bottle of Coke versus, you know, another type of a project with or a product which is trying to do clean water, mm-hmm. Or you know, some other product where the product is in itself very different and trying to create that that extra extra type of social impact and economic value, in that sense.
So the weightage for different things is different. I see. I got it. So you were in New York City, or you were working in New York City at this time, right?
Yes. Yes.
And you, in New York City, you walked into a store for shopping regularly. What happened when you walked into the store that changed the course of your life after that?
Sure. And so I had lived all my life in India and worked there, studied there. And so when I started working at UNICEF and really interacting with a lot of friends here in New Haven and going to a lot of the social events, etc., I started realizing that, you know, people dress very, very differently, of course, from India. And when I started shopping in the US, what, like, really living here and, like, not really shopping as a tourist, like, one time, but really walking into stores more often and realizing the life of how people live here and how they dress here, what I realized is that we're all going to the same stores, like, sort of the same stores, at least my friends and my circle, but the type of clothing that they are able to pick for themselves versus what I am trying to pick for myself, you know, there is a difference. And I used to always wonder, what is the special knowledge that these guys have? Like, what kind of magazines do they read, or what kind of content do they consume on Pinterest? And, well, even if they do, I don't have the time to do that. So what is a shortcut to all that? Like, how can I know, entering into a store, what should I pick up which is going to flatter my body and which is going to save me time to, you know, quickly go through the whole process and just make me look and feel good.
Yeah, you felt really like an outsider in some sense, that you didn't was going on.
And more than an outsider, I think I really started questioning the fact that retail as such, and especially offline retail, it feels like there is no layer of intelligence existing in the store. Neither the retailer is even interested mm-hmm. to create that layer of intelligence. It feels like you walk into a store and the retailer wants you to very quickly pick up something and get into the queue to the payment counter. They know that I'm going to come back to the store, you know, as I'm shopping in my next cycle or the next cycle. But still, there is no layer of intelligence really sitting there, which is trying to understand who I am, what do I like, and why am I here? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, so you had this kind of discontent with making purchases of clothes or other fashion-related products. And you were still working full-time in UNICEF at that time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so to just add to that, in India, I used to work for a startup called Echo. Mm-hmm. I worked there for about 3 years, started as the 10th employee and left after Series A. And I had got all my training of everything about startups mm-hmm. With that experience. I tasted blood, basically, as a young employee, you know, trying to and really seeing something.
You said something that you tasted blood. Like, I want to know more about that. Can you give me a specific example? What made you say that?
Yeah, so what I mean by that is, so like I said, I joined as the 10th employee and I joined in the sales and marketing team. Mm-hmm. So Echo is a product. At that point in time, you know, when I joined sales and marketing, we were, you know, I joined the team in Bihar where we were trying to sell bank accounts to very low-income groups, like a SBI bank account on the mobile phone, which is powered by Echo, to these you know, rickshawwalas, etc., different types of people. Mm-hmm. And I joined their sales team to just understand what the product is and how do you sell to your target audience? Like, mm-hmm. how does this whole thing work? I was a part of that team for about a year. I eventually led some circles and their sales teams. And then I transitioned into product. And then finally into the fundraising team, where I was a part of, you know, the various different vehicles of fundraising that we were using, equity, debt, grant, etc. And mm-hmm. and we successfully raised money on all three of those different projects. And So in those 3 years, really what I understood is that I felt like I have touched almost every part of a startup. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, I felt empowered to be able to believe that I understand what this is. And I know that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
I see.
And so I think that's what I mean by tasting blood, that you know, I picked up awards for Echo.
Tasted blood, I heard it in a kind of a negative connotation, in the sense that I saw things that went bad. But it sounds like things were going well for you at Echo, and you liked what you saw at Echo.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the one thing that I made sure that I would do differently when I would start up was that I would look for a problem that I have. So the product that we created at Echo and that we were selling at Echo, I wasn't a user of that product. Mm-hmm. I sold it for 3 years, but I never used it.
I see.
And so, because I was not the target audience. And mm-hmm. so at least that one thing that I decided or kind of made note to myself is that whenever I am starting up next, I am looking for a problem that I have.
I see.
And so while I was working with UNICEF in New York, and like after my MBA, when I was out in the market trying to find my next thing, I was very observant on my own problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how when I was entering stores around, when I was thinking, when I was being very observant of even my thought process of what I was thinking, what I was feeling when I was shopping, and when I was generally, you know, getting ready to go to work and looking at other women, I was just observant to see what I'm feeling and how my thought process is going on that.
Got it. So your earlier experience at startup and MBA and your current experience of, you know, having this challenge with
mm-hmm.
thing kind of came together, and the previous experience kind of primed you to think differently about the problem at hand.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what happened on the Sunday afternoon when you sat with your husband to brainstorm more about this problem?
Yeah, I mean, so so really that day, like I said, I knew that I have to look for a problem that I have. And so really we were just brainstorming on all different. So he was just plainly asking me this question: what problems do you have? And like after joking about it, I was like, okay, I have to go to work tomorrow. So I was going from New Haven to New York every single day. It's a 3-hour train ride from door to door. And wow. So I was like, I'll have to get up at 6 o'clock, then stand in front of my cupboard for at least half an hour trying to figure out what to wear, you know, just get comfortable with that. And so in that process of really listing down problems is where, you know, I felt that this whole thing about how I look
mm-hmm.
or what I'm going to wear and how it is going to make me look and feel
mm-hmm.
is something that I realized. So it's not really that I thought of a problem and I got an idea.
Yeah. So you knew that there was something there to explore more. This
Absolutely.
Problem of
I think
trying
it
to
was,
find.
And I'm also a kind of a person who's very attracted to existing behavior, who's very attracted to how emotions are involved in a particular product or a particular thing that we do in life, how excited or frustrated we feel while doing something and stuff like that. And so at least what I realized that afternoon was really just that this whole idea of self-identity, of what you wear, where you buy, and how you feel about, is something that women care so much about.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, like right then when we were talking and, you know, we were Googling and we found that women spend at least 3 years of their life in front of a mirror. Like, I mean, if you just total that,
in front of a
cupboard. In a lifetime. They spend 3 years of their life in front of a cupboard to just, you know, kind of stare and look at their cupboard and think what to wear.
So it's an important part of their life, and it's also tied to the self-identity.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I like the self-identity portion that you brought up. So I'm an immigrant as well. When I moved to the US, I kind of had a similar challenge, right? Like, how do I look good? And the self-identity that I had back home was one thing, and it was not based on what I dressed up as. But when I came to the US, it was not the same. So the what I wore actually mattered more for my self-identity here than it was back in India.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I had to get it right so that I am consistent with my knowledge of my view of myself. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So what was your... So you kind of figured out a area that you wanted to work on. Mm-hmm. And what was your first step at that time?
So in that regard, you know, of course, we did the standard stuff. I tried to, for the next 2-3 weeks, I tried to read about everything in the space, every, you know, I completely mapped the entire market with all different types of products, all different domains that, you know, different people are doing innovation in the retail tech space. Mm-hmm. And then...
So you went out there and figured out what everyone is doing in this space.
Yeah, basically. what's really happening because like I also mentioned, while it was a problem that I felt very compelled to touch, but mm-hmm. at the same time, I am not from a retail or a fashion background. Mm-hmm. So while that did not stop me, but at the same time, because I felt very closely about the problem as a user. Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, I wanted to make sure that I understand what's really happening in the market. Mm-hmm. And also Yale was a great platform for me as a Yale spouse to talk to some amazing folks during my journey. If it's the co-founder of Gilt or whoever, I mean, these amazing people came to Yale and I got a chance to speak to most of these folks. As a spouse trying to know more about this space as such.
Is this when you tried to build your first version of the product?
Yeah, and so at that point in time, we had one hypothesis, and the first hypothesis that I really kind of zeroed down was, so I was going from New Haven to New York all the time for work, and I felt like I want to be able to see the real-time collection of a store before I go to that store to shop, so that I can reduce my time in the store. And so I really thought that was... we were thinking about it more like a Google Maps for
merchandise or clothes.
So a Google Maps for a particular store inside a store, like almost like that.
Okay.
What's there in the store at that point in time? We were trying to position it like that.
Okay, the store and map inside the store map, basically.
And not really the store map, but mm-hmm. what's in a store? I mean, okay. I know it's kind of not a very good analogy, but. And so we were thinking about that.
So is it? I want to really understand this. Is it the inventory in each store?
Yes.
Inventory in each store.
Yes.
Okay.
So the real time inventory of every single retail store.
Got it. So how did you build the first product?
Yeah. So at that point in time, I think that was one of the hardest challenges that I had to come over, which is. Kind of without having a technology background as such, I had to just make myself aware of a lot of things before even knowing what am I going after, you know, to just make myself aware of the different tech stacks, you know, all sorts of different things for me to understand. Okay, there is a hypothesis and I want to go after like this, mm-hmm. but now in terms of execution, what am I going to do next? And so from that aspect, to look for a team that is going to build the entire back end, to look for a team that is going to build the front end, and all of that. And so that process was a difficult one, but at the same time, I think I really enjoyed that process with full knowledge that this may or may not be the best. I mean, I knew at that point in time that this is really more of a feature, not a product. But at the same time, I wanted to go ahead and do that because I really enjoyed doing going through the whole process from start to end.
Building a team, putting different pieces together.
Yeah, just writing the entire product spec and just executing on that. And so,
were you still working full time at this point?
Yes.
You did it part time in your evenings and weekends.
Yeah, and we also got we also won this fellowship from Yale, and so yeah.
How much did you win?
So it was a $5,000 scholarship that we win, that fellowship that we won.
Was it enough to build the initial version of the product?
Trust me. I mean, more than that, it is such an encouragement to hear from a set of investors that this is something that I should scratch and pursue
The reason why I asked was it app development is very expensive.
You said it is never enough. I think the answer
in India,
for that is
designers in New York and like the whole team, right? And
absolutely.
You said it was still in our pre-interview. You mentioned that you made 5K enough, which was a really great feat to pull off.
Absolutely. I mean, my husband is on a student loan, and at that point in time, I mean, I was making some money with UNICEF, but we were also trying to kind of support everything that was going on in life at that point in time. And so, I had to make the ends meet.
Yeah.
And I think that's the time, like at that point in time is when I also started realizing that's when you really realize what a founder's job is. I mean, right now it's about $5,000. The next thing is going to be about $500,000. The next thing is going to be about $5 million. It's never going to be enough.
Yeah.
There's always a new challenge. And so I think those are the things that, because I was able to realize all those very basic things about startups. I mean, so working with a startup and starting your own company is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though I had worked with a startup for 3 years.
You're not managing the finances.
Yeah, I mean, you can have an unsalaried month, which I did have when I was working with a startup. Like I was an employee, like all other employees in the company. There was a month where we weren't paid,
mm-hmm.
but that's still okay. But the more difficult part is on the founder's side,
mm-hmm.
where you have only so much money and you have to figure out how to motivate everyone, how to empower everyone to do their best.
Yeah.
In almost little or like no money, and so I think that's even more a difficult job than having an unsalaried month or like just being, being a part of a startup.
So was it financially? Was it just like it was tight and you could still manage, or did you really struggle financially at this time?
So I did try and stretch myself to make extra money at Yale.
Okay.
I mean, even if it was taking.
So you did struggle financially too.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, just 5K for. So at that point in time, I mean, now I feel more strongly that it was a feature, and I know facts. But when I was working on it, it was everything, right? And so you want to get the best of design, you want to get the best of everything, because you want to make sure that how you have imagined this product, that's how it should come out.
I see.
And so yeah, for some of those things, $5,000 is sort of less.
Got it.
So yeah.
No, but how about personally? Personally, also you had financial struggles. Leave the company aside.
Yeah, I mean, what is I mean, at this, so that situation continues even today. Founders don't get paid. Like there's nothing that founders get, at least.
It's not liquid, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not liquid at all. And so,
When did you give up your G4?
So when the product that we had built, when I realized that, when the market made me realize that it was a feature and not really a product, and I got great feedback from investors, friends, users, etc., that while this is great, but this is not really something that we will spend time on or use it as a product.
What do you mean? You released it to the App Store and there were not enough downloads to convince it was a product?
So we didn't even have to release it to the App Store. I mean, we could just get all the test and feedback from test flight. I mean,
you sent it to friends and friends said, yeah,
absolutely.
It's fine, but it's not something that you would.
Exactly.
Use
I mean, the moment you get honest feedback, that's
how do you get honest feedback, Purva? I find it very hard to do, because the friends, they don't want to disappoint you. They know you personally. So they try to say things nicely.
Yeah, so you don't really go to friends. You try and tell the friends, just send it to someone.
Ah, okay. So you took friends' network.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And, And so for me, I think to do that initial test was not difficult at all. And I'll tell you
doing
further.
Doing test is one, but getting honest feedback for on the test, that I'm curious how you did.
Yeah. So I mean, at least when I got feedback that, you know, this is not something that I'm going to, this is not, I'm not sure if I'm going to use this. I considered that as an honest feedback.
I see.
Let's just say that.
Got it. So you had some feedback.
And also when a lot of people, like when a lot of users who you don't know say that, you know, I think this is good information to have, but on another product. So let's say when I'm shopping at so-and-so other retailer, this will be good to know whether this thing is in stock or not. So, you know, you can know pretty quickly that, okay, that this is not a product, it's
Got
a feature.
It. Got it. When you were telling the story of, not story, but you were saying when you gave up your G4, which is when we digressed into this. When did you give up your G4 and when did you decide to move away or jump into your startup full time?
Yeah, so while I built that first product completely, and I got great feedback and the whole process was just too much fun and such an amazing learning opportunity. One thing that I had started realizing at that point in time, I used to discuss a lot of it with my husband. And so at least what both of us got convinced was that there is definitely a problem that we are scratching. Mm. There is something in this problem. Maybe this solution is not the right solution and which is totally fine. I mean, as founders, I mean, I had realized this early on that there is nothing to get attached to. If you want to get attached to, it's the problem, not the solution, because things will change.
Yeah.
And so at least what I was realizing was that there is something in there in the whole. So the few pieces were offline retail, like a physical store.
Yeah.
A layer of intelligence that understands who the user is, or knowing real time what's there in a store so that it's useful when it's most needed, when you are shopping.
I see.
When you're actually in a store and you're shopping in that process. Mm-hmm. And also pre-shopping, helping you in pre-shopping activity so that when you're doing the discovery process before you go to the store, there is some help on that front. So at least some of those pieces felt like we're scratching the right thing, but yet we do not know what is that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point in time, I had applied to Founder Institute, which is an incubator, and which felt like the right logical next step after I had kind of built something which didn't work, and I felt like I need more help in trying to understand, to find the next thing, and trying to find the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, I was accepted to. I applied to the Founder Institute program on West Coast, on the East Coast, in Washington D.C.
So you applied to both the one on East Coast and the one in Washington D.C.
No, I only applied to the one on East Coast. Somehow there was a turn of events in the family that I could not attend the one in Washington. And then when I was back from India after attending to some family events, the only one that was available at that point in time was in Silicon Valley.
I see.
And so
they accepted you and they asked you to move to Silicon Valley, basically.
Yes. And for me at that point in time, it was a very difficult decision because my husband was on the East Coast. Silicon Valley has been a dream that I was nurturing for about 3-4 years before that. I mean, almost from the time that I was an undergrad. But I didn't know how exactly would I be able to fulfill it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when I was married and very comfortable in my shoes to not think of a situation to live away from my husband.
Yeah.
And so at that point in time, while I knew that, okay, there is something interesting that I have in my hand that I want to pursue. I have a G4. Even though as an immigrant, I have an access to a job opportunity to be able to contribute to some meaningful job and also get reimbursed for that at that point in time. In that sense, an opportunity. And then, and also my husband was on the East Coast. So I giving up my job and getting away from my husband to move to Silicon Valley to just explore this interesting thing that I had was not easy at all.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think, you know, both me and my husband, we took a decision from our heart that it feels like this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And we just took the jump.
Yeah. And also financially, New Haven is probably half the rent than Palo Alto, for example.
Absolutely. And
you're so, not getting paid at Founders Institute as well. It's just a program where they mentor.
Absolutely.
Right?
It is just a program and it's a paid program.
Oh, it is a paid program.
So I asked for a scholarship, got that, you know, I did different things to be.
Oh, I see. It is a paid program. So it is not as bad as I thought it was. So that is good to know.
No, I mean, that program was the platform for me to get access to create my network in Silicon Valley. Absolutely, hands down.
What did you do when you moved to Silicon Valley, when you moved to Palo Alto? Mm-hmm. What did you do for the next few years here? Few months. What was your activity on now the new idea? Or what did you do to improve on the idea when you got here?
So the very first week of my time at Founder Institute, you know, it's a very fast paced program. It's a very rigorous program where they make founders go through different types of exercises for their startups and their ideas to refine and get to the next stage. In the very first week, they made me realize that what I had built, that product was crap and it's not going to work. Where I knew some part of it already, but then...
How did they do that so quickly?
So, at one of the happy hours, I mean, they just sat across the table to me and said, what you have is crap. It was that easy.
Right away.
Yeah, and then I shed two tears and I realized, yeah, maybe that's it. This is over.
Okay.
And so that's... It was very easy to just, you know, get away from that and just realize... And so actually in the second week, it was difficult for me. I did have a weak week where, you know, I felt like I've given up my job. I'm staying away from my husband. I'm crashing at a family friend's place to just, you know, kind of get started here. And also I don't have any idea. Like this, what I had was crap. And so I'm totally going to start from scratch, like, and I also don't know anybody else here, and so yeah, I did have a weak, mm-hmm. But that's.
Did you come back home and cry that week?
I mean, those, like I said, I mean, it was a weak, and I'm sure you can understand the rest. But I'll tell you, the more interesting part was that I was able to pick myself up, and tell myself that, okay, there are two ways to deal with this right now. One way is to not think about everything that I don't have and think about what I can create with a fresh mind, or go back home and go work with, you know, go back home and find another job or work with UNICEF or you know, just give up on my startup dream. Mm-hmm. And so I slowly started realizing my own strength and my own mettle to be able to deal with uncertainty from that second week onwards, because I knew that the weeks that were coming ahead of me, they were not going to be easy.
But at the same time, the week that you
absolutely
just
it was just the second week, and when I decided to put my feet on the pedal, I knew that from now on it is only going to get difficult. But then if I start thinking about my fears of what I don't have or what could go wrong, or mm-hmm. you know, all of those negative thoughts, then definitely nothing is going to happen. So I think that was a very interesting moment for me to realize that there is only one way to deal with this now. Let's start being fearless, almost try to be fearless, and just think of only the positive things that can come out of this, and let me see if I can really pick myself up and create something out of this experience. Yeah.
So they say that once you hit the bottom, the only way back is upwards, right?
Absolutely.
I appreciate you talking about the bad parts as well, because so many of us don't want to talk about those things, but they happen to all of us, and it's the reality of the situation. By not talking about them, I feel like we give an unrealistic bar. We set an unrealistic bar for others to meet. And everyone has these ups and downs, and it's important.
I absolutely agree with you, Rohit, because the other thing that I want to mention with that is I think hitting the rock bottom so many times in that journey was what added to my confidence and helped me realize. I do look back at some of my moments when these days when I am facing a challenge or a huge challenge, I am able to find confidence and strength in my previous experiences where I feel like, you know, I was in that situation and I came out of it. So I do have the strength somewhere. And so I think some of those experiences are extremely important for us to realize our own potential of what we are capable.
Yeah. So I studied for JEE and passed, and I studied at IIT, and during studying for that exam was a really arduous journey. I would spend like 12 hours or more every day studying for it, right? So whenever my life gets very busy, I look back on those days, though it happened like more than a decade ago now, and I tell myself, if I could go through that, I can go through this. So I can totally relate to what you mean when you say it gives you confidence in the future. So you moved to Palo Alto and you started talking to customers. You started talking to people to get an idea of your new product, what it's going to be like. How many people did you talk to?
So like I was mentioning, in the second week, my fantastic mentors at the Founder Institute program, they were like, okay, well, let's start fresh. Why don't we just, you're an alien in this country. You don't understand how women shop here. Why don't we just do customer development and understand about shopping behaviors here? And so I took that up very seriously. The program wanted me to speak to about 300 women in 2 weeks, because it was a consumer product, and so they wanted me to speak to about 300 women in 2-3 weeks and try and understand their stories. And so I started that process of speaking to women. And I felt like I fell in love with just knowing those stories, because the specific customer development approach that I picked up was a very simple one, where
is it Justin Wilcox method?
Yeah, where I was just trying to understand their last shopping behavior and ask them very simple questions around it.
I see.
And also the second thing that I made sure that I was doing was that I saw their face to be able to see their reactions and frustrations and all those very softer things. And so in that process, what happened is that after I crossed the 300 mark, I realized that I wanted to talk to way more women. Mm-hmm. And I'd sort of already started that process at Yale because of the previous product that wasn't doing well. And so it felt like I was very confident that something is going to come out of this customer development exercise. And so what I ended up doing was that for the next 3-4 months, I spent a lot of time just doing that. Yeah. And to the effect that I spoke to 1,000 women plus in that process of, so let's say roughly about 6 months from previous to Founder Institute to the end of my program, where I was just trying to understand the shopping behavior, because I already had an unsuccessful product where I'd sort of burnt my fingers, right? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make sure that I get to the nerve of this.
Yeah. And when you say talk to the people, is it like a 1-hour conversation or a quick 5-10 minute conversation?
No. It was not more than 15-20 minutes where,
oh, I see. Okay.
Where I would just try to kind of understand just about their last shopping experience. I mean, of course, you know, okay, chit-chat, understand, you know, introduce. But at the same time, I would just want to know about their last shopping experience and not take a lot of time.
I see. So rather than asking them what's your problem, you just ask them about last shopping experience and try to glean their problems out of the conversation.
Absolutely. Because those stories of what they would tell me, I went to Santana Row and so-and-so thing happened and I was looking for this and I couldn't find this. And then I went to this store and then I was trying to look for that. Those stories were really, really rich.
Yeah.
And
you were going, what you said to me earlier, very concisely, you summarized the result of those 1,000 conversations you have had into one line. What was your finding?
So my key behavioral insight that I found out of those conversations was so simple that at first I wouldn't believe that how can it be this simple? And so what I really found that was that women, when they are trying to buy clothes, they are trying to find clothes that accentuate certain parts of their bodies that they like and de-emphasize certain parts that they don't like. Mm-hmm. And so when I kind of arrived at that key insight after like so many conversations, I was like, this is not possible. I mean, this is so simple. How can I get, like, after 1,000, I thought I would get something way more different. I mean, how can it be this simple?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this key insight, you said it better, which is accentuate certain parts and de-emphasize certain other parts. And you had this insight. This is when you met Nitin. We talked about that experience in the beginning. Also, I want to mention quickly that if anyone is interested in Nitin's program, I have a full interview that I did with Nitin, where he explains his program and how it works and so on, which I'll leave a link to in the show notes as well. So then you get accepted into the Nitin's fund, and you applied for H1 with Nitin?
Yeah, so it's a little bit different than just getting clearly accepted to his fund. Uh-huh. You know, it's a process that you go with an investor. And so at least, you know, we were in a portfolio deal with them where they applied for my H1B. Mm-hmm. And then I had to meet certain other milestones before Unshackled decided to invest. Mm-hmm. And at this point in time, they are leading our current funding round. Mm-hmm. Unshackled is our lead investor at this point in time in our current round. And with most of these investors, I mean, the relationship starts way early before they make the final decision.
Got it.
And so and also especially with our case, with my case, where I was also looking for support with respect to my immigration challenges.
Yes, they applied for H1, but it got rejected, right?
So, yeah, they applied for my H1B.
This was in April 2015, I believe.
Last year's cycle. And since it's a lottery-driven process, I wasn't able to find success in that. Well, that happened. And then to this year, where it was again a lottery-dependent process, and I have found success.
Yes, that's a very good ending to the story. The last time we talked, it was not, we didn't know about that. So we definitely want to come to that. But before we go there, is it when in May 2015 you met Lori?
Yes. And so after I had my hypothesis in my hand, which is the key behavioral insight that when women are trying to shop, they're trying to find clothes that accentuate mm-hmm. certain parts of their body and de-emphasize certain other parts. I was still struggling to figure out how does this get converted into a product and into a product that is usable in my key interest areas of how I was thinking about the problem, which were in a physical store, in real time. And, you know, some of those different aspects that I wanted to make sure were a part of the product.
Yeah.
Because those were issues that I was trying to address. And so at that point in time, I was trying to understand that particular challenge, and I happened to meet Lori on our team, who helped me understand that there is a way to dress a woman that flatters her body, mm-hmm. and I mean, this is a science that a lot of people use in the world, including makeover shows or Hollywood, etc., where before and after, there is a before and after. The same woman is looking different just because of the type of clothes, cut, fabric, color that she's wearing, which flatters her body very differently.
Yeah.
And so what we ended up understanding is that there is a science to dress a woman that will flatter her body. And so using this hypothesis, we were able to together develop a science, develop that algorithm, or start developing that algorithm that would take input from a user of what they would like to hide and show in their body,
yeah.
and spit out results of products mm-hmm. that they should look at if they are trying to hide and show something in their body.
What was the first version of the product look like?
So the first version of the product, we were calling it One Look at that point in time, where there was a standard quiz that a user would be able to take. And then the quiz was asking more questions about preferences and style, mm-hmm. and was spitting results of products that would be able to, that would cater to the preferences of the user.
Yeah.
But what happened in that process, again, through a lot of user feedback, through rigorous feedback, what we understood is that while that was great, that was not bad, that was great, and there were other products in the industry which were trying to address that specific preference problem. But I think what we realized is that we were trying to build the relationship between machine and human that we were trying to explore was that of a friend who you could share your deepest secrets with, than of an assistant. So let's say, for example...
So by asking questions, you are more on an assistant model, which is not appropriate for the problem that you're trying to solve.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so from the Alexas of the world to the Siris or Cortanas or Facebook Ms of the world, which were all trying to build assistants to kind of be, to in a very mechanical way solve the problem, yeah. we realized that we weren't trying to do that. We were trying to understand how a user was thinking. And so at that point in time, we realized that the algorithm had to be built very differently. Different types of questions had to be asked, and they had to be asked differently to the user.
Yeah.
And so November 2015 is when Lily was born, mm-hmm. where we realized that there is an emotional relationship that we are trying to build with the user, and we are trying to ask them questions that help us understand how they think about their own body.
Yeah.
What are their strengths and weaknesses? What are their perceptions about their own body? And
so at this time, Lily was also asking questions like One Look.
So yes, absolutely.
So
but,
what was different in then?
So the types of questions and the way the questions were being asked.
Okay.
So
can you give an example so that so I can understand?
Yeah. So initially with One Look, we were asking about 40 questions all one at a time. And they were not really attacking.
What is one question you would ask in One Look, for an
example? So let's say it would be related to preferences. Let's say about the different types of cuts,
okay.
and you know colors that a user
likes.
What
color is your preference for clothes? That would be a question in One Look.
So what types of colors would you prefer when you're trying to buy a dress or a top or something like that?
That would be a question in One Look. How
yes.
would that question change in Lily?
So in addition to that, the question that we would ask in Lily would be something like, how do you perceive different parts of your body?
Mm-hmm.
So to understand. So let's say, for example...
But that is not specific to the color, right? That doesn't tie
yeah,
with the color.
Yeah,
so you would
yeah,
not
so,
ask about color at all in Lily.
No. So we do ask about color, but first we try and understand about their own perceptions about their own body, which is very... Because the other thing that we realized was that when I took all of that data of 1,000+ conversations with women back to a few social psychologists at Yale, some of my friends, what I really understood is that girls as babies at the age of 2 start recognizing themselves in the mirror. And since that time, they start disliking something in their body.
Mm-hmm.
And so as they grow up as teens, they start making their perceptions that, okay, I have fat thighs or I have a tummy or my arms are like this. And they start making these perceptions and everything is relative. They look at their mommies, aunties, celebrities, friends, etc.
Yeah.
Because there is no scale which says this is thin or fat or this is whatever.
Yeah.
And so what our aha moment really happened when we were making the switch from One Look to Lily was when we realized that women buy clothes based on their perceptions
mm-hmm.
about their own body.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you'd ask the questions more about their perceptions. Right?
Exactly.
I see.
And so we would still ask about the reality.
Yeah.
We would still ask about your measurements and, you know, about the sizes, etc.
It's not like you take one question and then ask it differently to make it a Lily question. It's like totally different set of questions and totally different perspective. And you're trying
Absolutely.
To more learn about the person in the new version.
We are going
of that.
Way deeper into a woman's psychology than we were going before. Let's say it like that.
Yeah. And once you started building this product, you got to test it with Macy's, right?
Yeah, so we recently had a pilot with Macy's inventory.
Recently,
where,
wasn't it in 2015?
So I mean, this was around in January this year.
I see. Okay.
And so where we tested the inventory, where we tested our algorithm with the inventory of dresses from Macy's, and we tested this with a few users, where more than 88% users clicked on the buy button for at least one product that Lily recommended. And so it was a very strong validation, even though it was a small set of users. It was a good validation for us to understand that this new thought process, this new hypothesis of how we could help women discover clothes is something that they are interested in. So after we got women to like or dislike or buy products from Lily, we also spoke to them, almost all of them personally, to try and understand what they were thinking and what were some additions that we could make, of course, to the product. And so at least what we understood in that process is that women really like this approach that somebody is trying to understand them. And it seemed like a very different type of personalization to them, and also something which is actionable for them. So it's not like a subscription box that comes home, or it's not, this would be a layer on top of their existing behavior, which is to walk into a store.
Didn't disrupt their existing behavior, which was what...
Yeah, it would ride on their existing behavior and facilitate and help in their existing behavior of walking into stores and...
Got it.
And you know, finding clothes.
So you found validation with Macy's and our Macy's customers. What was your next step?
So the next step was to... So this pilot was where we had the algorithms built, the backend was ready, but the front end was really done on Google Forms. I mean, so, I did it manually to kind of ask them these questions and then use our backend to generate recommendations and send those back to them. And so the next step was for us to understand the entire user experience, how the whole thing will pan out, and how do I still create the front end, which is extremely important to understand how easy will it be for a user to use this in their, when they are walking into stores or online. Mm-hmm. And so at that point in time, we understood that one of the best ways for us to build the front end was to leverage chat. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, right now chat is one of, and even in January, chat has been in the last 6 months has been one of the hottest hottest platforms for people to build their products or services on.
That's very interesting to me. I was looking into app development, and people say that it's going away. Most apps, there are too many apps on people's phones that it's an overload of apps. So people are going with messaging platforms.
So the verdict is of course still to be out.
Yes.
But at least my understanding is that with chat, everything is about instantness.
Yes.
And so we were leveraging chat so that we could instantly understand from the user. We could instantly do at least 2-3 checkpoints with the user about the same thing when they are in a store, when they are looking for something, or when I have to ask a question to the user and I immediately want an answer so that I can supply them something immediately. Mm-hmm. Right? And also the fact that, because we were trying to build an emotional relationship, it would definitely, we thought that it would definitely help if the user understands that this is a person. This is, even though Lily is a technology, but, it is in the form of a person, a girl, who sort of understands the regular problems or the real life problems that we all have as women.
Yeah. So you went to the messaging platform and you started building the product. Is this when you started getting or started exploring the full-time funding?
So we started fundraising in February where, we were still pre-product. Mm-hmm. And we had a few validations. Our team was coming together. Our technology was coming together. So,
but it was, at this time, it was still people working part-time and trying to
yes,
help out.
Yes,
to
absolutely.
Out.
It was still a combination. We had raised about 50K last year, which was, extremely difficult for us to kind of, for a team like ours and for a product like ours, for us to survive.
Yeah.
But we were able to manage. And so we started about, at that point in time, we're raising about $500,000. We have half of it committed. Mm-hmm. We're trying to look for the rest. And so
Did the people you are trying to work with quit and join full time?
So not yet, because they haven't yet quit their nice jobs and joined me full time. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they have made the product happen. So we're actually releasing the iOS version of Lily in the next 2 weeks.
Oh wow!
And so,
exciting.
So
actually, by the time this mm-hmm. interview would have aired, we would have probably had it out, or we'll try to coordinate so that we do it on the same day. If you're okay with
fantastic.
That.
Fantastic. And so the interesting part is that my team has made sure that we are able to meet deadlines, even though they are working part time. And I think it is not easy for. It is not easy to juggle between two jobs. And I mean, I have done it myself and I understand the place that they are coming from. But the interesting thing is that their belief in what we are building is so strong that we are all able to manage and deliver stuff on time. And at the same time, keep as much excitement to build this as we had on day one.
And you also got your H1 for you to be able to continue working on this idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So congratulations on that.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
So what's next for Lily and what's next for Purva?
So for Lily, the next thing is we're launching the product, hitting milestones one after the other in terms of it's a consumer product, getting users, engagement. We have a set of KPIs, metrics, milestones, hitting those week after week, going
executing.
For absolutely, aiming for more than 20% growth week on week. I mean, from now on.
Week on week?
Absolutely. I mean, wow. those are things to target, right?
Yeah.
Those are the goals to set. And so
I will leave a link to your app in your app store link to the Lily app in the show notes as well. Or someone can go to breakingtheborders.com/Lily to download it right away. So how about for Purva? What is next?
Fantastic, Rohit. Thank you so much for that gesture. For me, at this point in time, so personally, I feel way more committed to the mission of helping women look and feel their best. So just to give a small aside on this, women in this country, more than 80% women in this country are not happy with their appearance. And to share how dark that thought is, women on an average in this country get 30 negative thoughts about their body every single day. Mm. And so what I'm trying to get at is that how women look and feel about themselves is something that that is very disproportionately wrong, or how as a society we have what we have come to of what are the standards of what is good and bad and how you look, which all goes back to self-identity, is, I think, skewed.
Yeah.
And so not just with Lily, I mean, I feel like it is my personal mission now to be able to make women with Lily and otherwise feel good about who they are. And also just I mean, make this difference, this big difference to the world.
So Purva, what advice do you have for others starting out?
So I'll keep this crisp. My biggest advice to anybody else that I've practiced and learned myself is that till you don't ask, the answer is no. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, one thing that I stick by now because of my experiences. Every single thing, if it was about Founder Institute, if it was about Unshackled, if it was about other investors that we raised money from or members on my team,
yeah.
The product, about everything else. I think whenever I just followed whenever I just followed the strong reason in me to say that I want to do this, or maybe I should explore this, and not really question, will they really listen to me, or will they do it, or why will they do it, or some of those things. Because I've hired from AngelList, LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I remember I had no connection here. So all of my team really comes from either AngelList or LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And now we've all been together for a year. So my advice to people, you know, who are starting from scratch would be that
ask.
Anything is possible. Just reach out, try, do it. If you that badly want to do it, I think there is a solution out there. And I think that's what really powers me even today, that in the face of so many uncertainties of, you know, all sorts of different things, that all sorts of specific challenges that my business has, I think what drives me is the fact that we've come so far with just badly wanting to solve the specific things that we wanted to solve. And it feels like if we just continue to do that and not give up and have enough courage and excitement and energy to be able to build this and believe in what we are building, there is no way that we will not be able to build.
Yeah, that's a good point. And before asking, we keep telling a bunch of lies to ourselves why someone will say no. But oftentimes, it's all just in our head. And you have to get over yourself to just ask. When I started this podcast, for example, I would not ask for people for an interview, because why would someone say yes to me? Now, 50 odd interviews later, I'm not worried about asking anymore.
Absolutely. So, and like a lot of very senior investors in this valley have been saying recently, I think you have to be rational at some point.
Mm-hmm. Irrational?
Yes, almost yeah. Irrational, pursuing what you think you're pursuing. Mm-hmm. Like I use the word irrational because rationally you wouldn't chase it.
Yeah.
Because there would be so many facts that would tell you, yeah, maybe this guy is not going to answer you, or this guy is not going to respond to your email. Yeah. But I think at some point, as in your entrepreneurial journey, at some point, meaning I mean at so many points in the journey, you're just being irrational and chasing something with crazy amount of conviction that you know, I don't care, I think this is possible, and let me just try.
Even if that doesn't work out, something else will.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that kind of attitude is so important.
Purva, this has been such a blast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was absolutely my pleasure, Rohit.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again, and have an amazing day.